Good evening, everybody, and welcome to our slightly irregular Wednesday stream. I'm joined, of course, by my co-host, although not always. People were missing you those times you went on.
Oh, no, not missing me.
Evelyn's here, guys.
Yes, sorry. I suppose I must apologise both to the people in the audience and also our guest that we have this evening, who I will introduce in a moment. Because we were supposed to do this last week, but both of us were incredibly ill.
We got the weather report is sneezing.
Yes, so we can see you're not getting a weather report this week. You're getting a health report. We are much better, so that's good. But I suppose without further ado, I should welcome Rory onto the stream for this evening.
Hello, thank you for having me.
For those who don't know, Rory is the editor of the Islander magazine, done by the folk over at the Lotus Eaters. For anyone that pays attention on Twitter stuff, I think has become apparent, especially in the last little while, you've joined us in a certain line of thinking, and even to a certain extent have maybe gone a little bit beyond us with a specific subset of research that I think we would have got to in time, but the fact that you've kind of dived into it has given us an excuse to do the same. And there's a lot...
Yeah, it's weird.
So hopefully there should be a lot of useful stuff in this stream for people who maybe still can't fully picture why we've focused on containment so heavily and so specifically, and what the reasons really for that focus are. I suppose before we rush into all that, though, it'd be worth mentioning that if you want to support these streams or how we go about doing other stuff, you can become a member through the channel on YouTube, or you can give a super chat and we'll read it out, or a super sticker if you're Lamented Guide and you're weird. But thank you for your weirdness. And also donate directly to the Ko-Fi if you don't want YouTube to tax it. And there is also the Substack there. And also, seeing as Christmas is coming up, I'm going to implement my MK Ultra mind rays through the microphone in front of me. You will buy anti-politics for everyone at your office, Secret Santa.
Logos, I remember.
You will buy book.
Where's buy book number two? Got a few bits for the buy book. Buy book. There.
If you want to know more about what I'm getting it here, buy books. Other than that, don't ask me.
Well, thank you for buying book.
And you too, bookless viewer, you too can also have a book, but you have to buy it, I'm afraid.
I think I might have deleted the other book thing.
No!
We've got plenty of buy book adverts.
How will people know that we're engaging in some sort of Maoist marketing campaign?
Because we got this one.
Oh, buy book, comrade.
Buy book, comrade. Buy
right.
book.
let's get the show on the road, because we've not got all day.
No, we do not have all day. Do you want to give a very kind of quick intro, Rory, to the kind of the stuff that you looked at? Because you've looked at a guy called Kitson. Frank Kitson, yes. His counterinsurgency framework, which is something I've seen mentioned a few different places. David Betts, I believe, was the in for you for that, and well, partly for me as well. But I've also seen that reference in other places too. It's something that has been in our kind of wheelhouse. We've talked about gangs and counter gangs a little bit before, actually.
Yes,
but only offhand and things like that. It's counterinsurgency is something that we mentioned a little bit way, way back when we did a stream called War on Terror Comes Home. We also mentioned, I believe, somewhat in our Libya stream about Qatari money, but what it does and what it doesn't do.
But I think maybe the lead-in line, and I think it's one of the things that really got me, and I'll be totally honest, I am jealous and wish I came up with it myself, that if elite theory is the sort of doctrinal theory, then counterinsurgency and insurgency is the praxis.
Yes.
Once you have learned how groups, and particularly organized groups, function, how they can form into a hierarchy, and how one must end up becoming subservient to another, you then, well, how do you make one group subservient to another? How do you make your own group not the one that's subservient, as it were? And, well, there's a lot of interesting questions I think we'll get into off the back of that.
Well,
I was going to say there's kind of this, it's interesting because there's a tradition on the left of reading Kitson, I remember Bastani talking about him years ago. So I've sort of known about him on the periphery for years, but, you know, I've sort of gone back to it recently since, you know, people have started talking about Counter Gangs more. And, you know, it's as I said in that tweet, you know, people seem to think about Elite Theory in the abstract, but there's an actual sort of framework which is applied to real life politics going way back to the 60s, which actually forms this sort of concrete basis with which we can look at containment and counterinsurgency down the line. So it's quite interesting in that sense.
Yes, and it seems as well there appears to be a through line both in Kitson and in Betts' work of a character, Marshall McLuhan, who spent more of his time talking about the Cold War. But what he really...
Is that Marshall McLuhan?
Marshall McLuhan.
Marshall McLuhan, yeah.
What he really seemed to identify, and it's something that we talked as an entire through line in the democratization series we did years ago, that the increasing intensity of political systems upon a population and the fact that more people in turn then become involved in politics has totally changed the way that you go about war. And that conflict is now, as is sort of mentioned here, a sort of low intensity, constant hubbub that rarely gets kinetic, but when it does, the narrative around that kinetic component becomes the most important part.
Yes.
And this is really what the brilliance of some of this stuff, I think.
Well, it also it also links into some of the stuff in the Imperium one, the one that mentions the juvenile Nemesis,
the Bond, yes,
Nemesis, Thea Bond's Nemesis. In that, what we see on the other side of this are operations like the Arab Spring and things like that. Sorry, you were saying, Roy?
No, what was it to say? It's interesting. Have you read Lone Since the Operations yet?
Not all of it. We've sort of picked through bits and pieces of stuff because we've got some other bits going on at the same time. So I must admit, we're trying to, I think, pick the best bits out of this without having to like completely deep dive into all of it.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I've read the bits where the quotes you've sent come from.
Yes.
I've tried to read around it as much as possible. I will say I have read it, but not intently. I've skimmed it and I've read the quotes you've given us and I've read it as much as I read a lot of stuff, to be fair, because it's not... I'm probably going to read it cover to cover at some point, but yeah, we'll have the caveat that me and Evelyn have not read this cover to cover yet, but we have pulled out a lot of the quotes, and I've seen it used secondarily in quite a few places. So it's something... I don't want to say I've read it completely, but I have read through it.
Yes, and I think as well, given the fact that I spent quite a bit of time reading Alul and a bunch of other things about propaganda here and there, the sort of two-part thinking of propaganda as the psychological and the organisational, which is, I think, a large part of all this stuff really is attempting to describe, is something that we kind of slip into a bit more naturally. So when... I mean, I don't know if we want to start getting through some of the stuff here, but I think one of the first ones you'd posted on Kitson that I'd sort of said, oh, you know, maybe try and keep that for the stream we're going to do, is where he directly mentions this notion of containing movements.
Yes.
Which is something we've now used as a bit of a buzzword, but it really goes to show the interaction and engagement between effectively secret services, intelligence forces, and media campaigns that need to act in lockstep for an operation like this to work.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, quite early on in the book, he's sort of talking about the democratization of the information space. You know, bear in mind this is written back in the late 60s, early 70s. And he's talking about how this needs to be countered by essentially a greater centralization of military intelligence with the government itself and, you know, all the entities around that. So it's quite indicative really of where we are now, like as to how they apply these sorts of principles to us as a potentially subversive movement. You know, this is
I'll head through this one.
The framework in itself, but you know, he's part of this genealogy and sort of
What I can do is make sure that I'll make sure that you're seeing what we've got on screen as well. I'm trying to make sure we've got the OBS virtual camera. Oh, that's just the other camera. Give me a quick sec because I can make it so you can see our OBS output. via our not quite real camera. It makes it a bit easier, so you're able to see the stuff that we're putting on the screen. Just, Oh, right. This should now be showing you. There we go.
Yeah.
It looks backwards to us, but not backwards to him. This is just what we've got on screen, so you can follow on. But this, we're going through the kind of the first few quotes you put up there.
But this again, it's really starts to sound like something we more know at the back of our hand, which is Matt Goodwin's stuff. And yes. Clearly, if I was able to get more of Goodwin's original sort of source material in his first bits of writing about how he got to the sort of right response framework, it would have had to come from this stuff, because I'll now read this bit out now that's been up on the screen. With the major weaknesses of non-violent action in mind, it's possible to consider a general framework of operations suitable for combating it. For the purposes of this study, no account will be taken of the simplest method of all, which to suppress the movement by the ruthless application of naked force. Because although non-violent campaigns are particularly vulnerable to this sort of action, it is most unlikely that the British government, or indeed any Western government, would be politically able to operate on these lines if it wanted to do so. Another point Matt Goodwin comes across. You can't just censor these people. You've got to do something else about it. In practical terms, the most promising line of approach lies in separating the mass of those engaged in the campaign from the leadership by the judicious promise of concessions, at the same time imposing a period of calm by the use of government forces, backed up by the statements to the effect that most of the concessions can only be implemented once the life of the country returns to normal.
Yes, this is exactly what would happen. Again, it's telling as well that he caveats this by saying that Western governments really are weak, and that the political capital they would have to expend to actually suppress people openly would shatter them, because they have no ability to openly use force and justify it properly. The people, we talk about permission of the governed, but if you look in quote-unquote Western nations by the 1970s, the populations will not brook a government that openly acts. It has to act through subterfuge, because political trust and quite frankly, political buy-in from the majority client group is so low. Mm-hmm. By design, most as we'll go through this, you'll see that a lot of this has been re-aimed at the majority client group, i.e. the ethnically British population. But it is a very good opener to be like, well, technically they can do this, but this would really, you know, the game would be up.
Yes.
You can't pretend to be a liberal government whilst openly suppressing non-violent dissent.
Yes, and it goes to show as well that the long-term strategy here is not to lead what you believe to be the insurgent group into a trap and ultimately shut it down. What we're really getting is a sense here that over the longest period of time, you will continue to make use of these people for as long as it is relevant to you.
What was your overall impression from reading the book then? What, in terms of, before we go through this next quote, in terms of Kitson, what do you think his overall message is, and how do you think it is applied, you know, now?
Well, he's viewing subversion and insurgencies to sort of, yeah, obviously one leads to the other, but it's a spectrum. And throughout the book, he's essentially making recommendations. It's one of those books you need to read between the lines, but it's essentially a series of recommendations made to government. You know, he was commissioned to write this book. I forget the name of the guy who supervised him, but he wrote it at Oxford University for the government. And essentially, he's making these recommendations, which amount to, you need these frameworks in place to get in front of these movements before they can even spawn into something resembling organization. You know, he says in one point of the book, I'll read it out now. He said, looking in retrospect at any counter subversion or counterinsurgency campaign, it is easy to see that the first step should have been to prevent the enemy from gaining an ascendancy over the civil population, and in particular to disrupt his efforts at establishing his political organization. So it's essentially about it's like a game of whack-a-mole. They're looking for these little hotspots of dissidents, and they want to clamp down on them straight away. So I think at the time he was writing, you know, Northern Ireland was going on and whatnot, but they've obviously taken these lessons from the book, and I think they apply them quite succinctly to the modern day.
Well, when you look at this and you look at some of the extrapolation outwards of these methods to something like the War on Terror, you begin to see how what they mean by counterinsurgency is really just the shutting down of any non-hegemonic elements within a managerial society. What we talk about, the nuts and bolts of our political framework and theory, is that managerialism requires absolute hegemony. That's why creating your own propaganda, in quotes, doesn't work, because you can't do counter-hegemony propaganda properly. Alul explains this in that without small groups, without defined groups, and without being part of a group that's already insulated from propaganda, there is no way to go against it, really. Mm-hmm. If you are completely atomized, if there is no small group that shelters you, then you are naked before it. That's one of the best parts of his work, and it's something that Betts references in of itself, but reversed.
Yes, and I think what Betts talks about is the importance of story, the narrative, that your faction, be you the government in charge or you the insurgent party, has a cohesive sort of short and simple philosophy that contains a large element of truthiness to it. Yes. And there is an admittance of the fact that this is all really about, first and foremost, creating a dialectic and a dichotomy between two different groups. These two different groups don't actually have to exist for any of this to work.
No.
You just have to create the illusion that they do. And this is why we, for years now, have told people not to sit there and spend all day countering the libs on Twitter, because you're still ultimately in the frame. The frame is the problem, not one side of it. And that is why we have the problem, as we're about to get into the sort of next little bit here, is that there are a number of things you can do. There are strategies that you can implement, recognizing the importance of a narrative both outside a group and even more so within it, or in opposition to it even more so, that you can then just play around with it and destroy a group from within. The first is to implement the promised concessions so as to avoid allegations of bad faith, which may enable the subversive leadership to regain control over the certain sections of the people.
We have cut immigration by 80%.
Well, no. The concessions, it's not even really what they want. It's just, it's a nod in the right direction.
Well, that's what I mean, yeah.
The second is to discover and neutralise the genuine subversive element. The third is to...
I like how that skipped over.
Yes.
Go out and kill people. Third of all,
is to associate as many prominent members of the population, especially those who have been engaged in non-violent action, with the government. This last technique is known in America as co-optation, or adoption, as Matt Goodwin called it, and is described by Messrs. Hawke and Schoenbach as drowning the revolution in baby's milk. In a slightly different sense, the idea of placing a personal obligation for helping to keep the peace on every adult male in the community has been a feature of English methods in Saxon times. It's, give your enemy symbolic victories until they give up.
Yes.
He says throughout the book, he's hitting the importance of basically getting into people's minds and, steering things in the direction of essentially concessions. That's the only way to get in front of subversion, is to make the people think that you are giving them what they desire, basically.
Yes.
To give people a bit more context, the reason we're talking about Kitson now is because, one, he's cited by a whole bunch of defence organisation documents. He is cited multiple times by Rand Corporation studies reading around this. And especially he is cited by Mr. David Betts when you come to his counterinsurgency narrative stuff, as we'll get to. Some of the papers that completely discredit him, I would say, in the eyes of a dissident, to the point of the right response document. But this is where a lot of the David Betts framework of counterinsurgency, which he writes about in 2008, comes from.
But this is also where it begins to become a very idiosyncratic theory that, as you suggested, you have to read between the lines of.
Yes.
So in the face of people nowadays ranting and raving about how they're all getting banned on Twitter and that Keir Starmer's going to kill us all, let's consider this further point from Kitson here. Concerning the overall conduct of the campaign, it is worth making, which is that it may be disadvantageous to destroy a non-violent subversive movement if the only result is to find that a campaign of terrorism or all-out insurrection has been substituted for it. It is far easier to penetrate a subversive movement when it is using non-violent means than it is when the movement is wholly clandestine because of the number of the people overtly involved. And there's a subtle point here, but what he's trying to say is that when you fundamentally organise in the real world around concrete goals, you become a social structure totally outside of the framework of narrative and story that they are trying to engage with. That is why this stuff is even more important now to us than it was back then, because we are idiots and think we can organise ourselves on the internet.
Yes, that is another quite major point. There's more Kitson here. We'll go through that in a little bit. But I think those quotes, which are all from low intensity operations, those quotes are some of the most operative things that we'll talk about here. They are the basis of the theory of counterinsurgency, and they are, as you pointed out there, Rory, steeped in doublespeak.
I mean, even this edition of low intensity operations, which is an amended version from about 1990, I think, he talks about the difference in subversion and insurgency. And in this version, which is from LibCon, he's saying that subversion is all illegal measures short of the use of armed force taken by one section of the people of a country to overthrow those governing the country at the time. In the original versions, illegal wasn't in there. It was all measures short of the use of armed force. So, you know, he's well aware what he's doing here. And there's another book called Bunch of Five, which was written in the 90s. And at the end, he goes on this whole, like, amble about, you know, none of these measures should be applied in peacetime to a democratic population. And, you know, he's saying all this to try and, like, turn people off from the fact that this is actually used against the population. You know, they're saying, of course, he's basically saying, of course, we never use this against the people. This was only for quote unquote insurgents in places like Afghanistan, you know. So it's all quite sneaky, really.
But it's what I got as well. There's one of the other bets ones, which we will get around to referencing possibly at some point during this stream, but is something we will focus on maybe a little bit more as a follow up. But the 2008 one on counterinsurgency...
There's two large quotes in there we need to read.
Yes, and his focus there on global jihad and Muslims. You could replace global jihad with the far right in Britain and Muslims with its activists. And there is one-to-one stuff in there that we know and have read documents where they explicitly say that's what they're doing to us. So as you're sort of suggesting, there is an attempt to make sure there is no through line to this stuff. But if you can identify the things not said between the lines or apply what they're saying about radical Islam to yourself as a native Brit, it's shocking how close it comes, really.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, it's this whole one here, I don't think we should read, but the follow-up we should. Well, I don't know how much of this you want to read. What he talks about really is that the legal system... He has two quotes here about the legal system's implementation in counterinsurgency. And what it says here really... an excellent example concerns the way in which the law should work. Broadly speaking, there are two possible alternatives. The first one being that the law should be used as just another weapon in the government's arsenal, and in that case it becomes little more than a propaganda cover for the disposal of unwanted members of the public. For this to happen efficiently, the activities of the legal services have to be tied into the war effort in a discreet a way as possible, which in effect means that the members of the government responsible for law either sits on the Supreme Council or takes the orders from the head of the administration. The other alternative is that law and order should remain impartial and administer the laws of the country without any direction from the government. Naturally, the government can introduce new legislation to deal with the subversion, which can be very tough if necessary. And once this becomes law, the legal services will administer justice based on it. But the resulting situation is very different from that described in the first alternative, because in the second case, the officers of the law will recognize no difference between the forces of the government, the enemy, and the uncommitted parts of the population. Anyone violating the law will be treated in the same way, and the full legal procedure, complete with its safeguards for the individual, will operate on the behalf of friend and foe alike.
I mean, could it be any more obvious that this is really just a practical guide for the maintenance of oligarchy?
Well, it's the maintenance of managerial hegemony.
Well, I was actually going to say specifically with this bit, and what I think part of Betts is doing specifically with the Civil War narrative is he is taking the blame away from the individuals that are acting in a situation. By in that turn, I think, and that other one previously saying that, well, you just as a government operative are actually subject to the law just like everyone else. Yes. So you're really powerless to it. And the fact that the laws are combating this insurgency is just a consequence of the way that laws work. The Civil War narrative seems very much the same as well, and that there's an attempt to make it seem as if the government and the people that would be targeted, if we're to believe what he says, are innocent bystanders and not actually truly holding the reign of powers, because supposedly in the managerial view, government is weak, or the therapeutic view, I should say.
Well, there's a quote here from Bunch of Five we'll get into in a sec, but I'm sure you were... It's about as close to a smoking gun as you can get, a lot of these quotes.
Yeah.
Again, well, the actual bet stuff itself applies this directly to the amorphous internationalist nature of the war on terror, which is giving this a blank check. You know, what Kitson does try and engage in some apologetics and say this shouldn't be done with a blank check. But what we have now is the framework for the blank check.
I see. People in chat are thinking about it, and they're going to start working out exactly what's going. Hardest part is moving from a non-violent group to a clandestine force. Exactly. That is the hardest part to do internally in your own movement, but it's the easiest thing to accidentally do to someone else's movement when you squash it.
Yes.
I think within all this is an important illustrative point to be made, is that this entire sort of field of literature which Kitson is working in is fundamentally, you know, tried and tested within the British colonial experience. So, you know, he's working in Kenya against the Mau Mau. He's working in Malaya. He's working in Cyprus, Northern Ireland. And it's about all of his action there, quote unquote, counterinsurgency, is about maintaining law and order under the British system, i.e. it's a fundamentally conservative approach to dispelling any kind of dissident activity.
Yes.
So now that's been brought home, and you know, this is what journalists at the time, such as Roger Falago, were criticizing Kitson for. He's basically synthesized this framework for subjugation of any dissident populations within democratic countries, essentially.
Yes, and there's a bit we've got here from, is it a Gang of Five? Bunch of Five, sorry, that's the one. And again, they are very obviously recognizing the asymmetric aspects of sovereignty and governance.
Yes.
That we can't take hold of.
What Kitson's doing here is very, very harshly highlighting the fact that managerial governments aren't weak, and that the appearance of weakness is a lie.
Yes, and it's tactical. Yes. The fourth part of the framework concerns the law. No country which relies on the law of the land to regulate the lives of its citizens can afford to see that law flouted by its own government. Wink, wink. Even in an insurgency situation. In other words, everything done by a government and its agents in combating insurgency must be legal. But this does not mean that the government must work within the exactly same set of laws during an insurgency as existed beforehand, because it is a function of government to make new laws when necessary. The exception is everything.
Yeah.
The rule is nothing. The exception justifies everything.
Although the exercise of such power is usually and rightly subject to considerable constitutional restraint, blah, 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 he goes on to say that really what you do is you dispense with juries altogether. That's his main suggestion. That's his first suggestion there, is to undercut the needed subversion of trial by jury. What you do is you get rid of it.
Yeah. Oh,
ways by which
that has echoes to something in the news cycle at the moment, I think.
Yes. Well, I was going to read this, just that last sentence or two there. Ways by which the legal system can be amended range from changing rules governing the giving of evidence to dispensing with juries altogether, or even to introducing some form of internment without proper trial. It is a dangerous path to tread, and one that is justified only by the peril in which the constitutional government and democracy are placed by insurgency.
That last line has so much heavy lifting. It's like, look, you can use an insurgency really to justify anything. And counterinsurgency, as long as you portray it as existential, you can justify all things, because the worst thing in the world would be the managerial government falling.
I know some silly gentleman or lady involved in the Lords or whatever proposed some bill attempting to suspend a bloody trial by jury the other week. I, however, am reminded of what the Scottish government proposed during COVID.
Yes.
Which was the exact same thing, on the premise of it being a healthier way to go about it and you weren't going to spread COVID around. But really, at the time, I think they walked that back because it had too much of this effect.
Yes.
They were going to suspend trial by jury, and a whole host of people in Scotland went, now what the hell are you expecting to happen that requires you to do that? What's going to happen that's going to be so bad that it justifies us getting rid of that tradition? And really, in that sense of using some of this stuff like scare tactics, they actually scared everyone too much.
Yes, they did. There's one final quote here from Kitson. If you want to do this one as well, Evan, then we'll have a bit of an... Sorry, we don't mean to shut you out here, Rory. We're going to have a bit of a discussion about this once we've got through some of the material.
I'll quickly nip through this one.
Because
we can get the graph up next, and I think we can have a right good chat about that.
Yes.
The fish and water analogy comes, of course, from Mao Zedong, but it has been bent and extended to illustrate the required point. The illustration should not be carried too far because it has important limitations, one of the main ones being that in real life, those practicing subversion are themselves capable of, and indeed much concerned in, manipulating the environment, whereas the fish cannot do much about the water in which it swims. But from the point of view of those countering subversion, the analogy is a good one because it shows how operations, i.e. the rod and net technique, have to be tied in with wider administrative measures, i.e. dealing with the water in order to kill fish. Translated into normal terms, the aim of the government is to regain, if necessary, and then retain the allegiance of the population. And for this purpose, it must eliminate those involved in subversion. But in order to eliminate the subversive party and its unarmed and armed supporters, it must gain control of the population.
Yes. What he's, a roundabout way, what he's really saying, again, is hegemony, hegemony, hegemony. It's, you don't just kill the fish, you poison the water. He's really, really telling, you know, reading between the lines here, he's really telling people who read this to go further than Mao.
And I think, especially as well, we'll not get into it too much, because it's not the only context we want to view this in, but specifically in the regards that you were mentioning that as a quote to, or a quote tweet as a response to AA.
Yes.
Identifying this, like, the same thing we have, and maybe hasn't, he hasn't expressed, maybe as precisely in certain places. Containment isn't going to go away.
No.
It's changing the state of play and the environment in which it operates so as to make sure it can operate more effectively. If that means giving up on the tiniest little bits of, you know, what they can sell to us as their sacred cows, then we get to think we've got some little victory here.
This looks a bit complicated, but really it's surprisingly simple. Rory, do you want to quickly talk us through this graphic? Because I think it's very good.
I want a little round of applause, by the way, for this, because I think this thing's a work of art.
It works pretty well. I think, despite it being a bit intimidating, it is a good explanation. So.
Yeah, it's so Kitson's probably most famous for his idea of gangs and counter-gangs. and pseudo gangs. So pseudo gangs and counter gangs, it's not very well laid out in this chart, but pseudo gangs and counter gangs are essentially the same thing. Counter gangs, but with slightly different applications. So counter gangs will be your kind of movements on the side of a main grievance, which are sort of accepted by the state or allowed to exist. And they're also there to be infiltrated by the state. You know, with, they'll come in and try to get informants or people to sort of lead certain movements or bodies of those movements in a way which is directly beneficial to the state. On the opposite side of that, pseudo gangs are sort of those, they're essentially psyops. You know, Kitson throughout Low Intensity to Operations is talking about the importance of psyops. He looks to the US a lot for this. So these will be your sort of mimic groups, your actors who your feds basically, who will come in and try to stir sort of point subversive actors in a way which will toward like a sort of honey trap, or you know, to discredit the movement entirely. And there's other applications involved in that, but all of this is essentially to create this feedback mechanism where these movements are essentially trying to organize. However, what the state wants to do is really to contain that by fracturing it and ultimately putting the most vocal or the people who are most able to create that organizational infrastructure into jail or silence them for good, basically. So this is what this chart sort of attempts to share.
And I want to stress as well that for the situation we are in, I actually believe this subversive slash insurgent movement in this graph doesn't actually exist. I think a large part of what containment is, as let's say a redeveloped form of counterinsurgency for the digital age, is as much about inspiring the insurgency as it is controlling it.
Well, if you have enough counter gangs, pseudo gangs, and if you create enough noise out of these elements on their own, you're able to create a self-sustaining engine here with very little needed in the way of quote-unquote gangs.
Yes.
You don't actually need any gangs involved. All you really need are the counter-gangs and pseudo-gangs.
But we could really take this and simplify it.
Yes.
The army, the government, you know, that's Keir Starmer and the Home Office in MI5. I like to maybe put a bit more of a simplistic twist on it, but I see the counter-gangs as something like Hope Not Hate or Stand Up to Racism.
Yes, and well, they can be, yes.
And your pseudo-gangs are something like Tommy Robinson in the later form of the EDL or some of these flag groups and what have you. And really what you actually get as well is much of an effect whereby one man's counter-gang is another man's pseudo-gang.
Yes.
You know, we fall for Tommy Robinson in the same way the left falls for Hope Not Hate.
Or Just Stop Oil.
And that if one of the major parts of this feedback loop is that it constantly creates division and stops there being momentum behind a left-right anti-Zionist alliance, then it's fundamentally achieving one of its main goals. And that we could talk specifically there about how, as rogue sort of pseudo-gangs, Tommy Robinson and these little Mossad people that run around are running their own renegade counterinsurgency operation against the British people, without even possibly involvement of the British government, unless it's on a very high level where they sort of just turned a blind eye to it. But we really could, I think, quite easily stick a lot of the characters. So we even within the gang itself, we could think about people like Matt Goodwin trying to force their way in.
Yes.
People like Caelan Robinson, that guy that used to work for bloody Lauren Southern and all that then went to Hope Not Hate. You know, there's one of your defected actors. There's your New Culture Forum sort of narrative sort of seeding that funnels back into us, that disrupts our own line of thinking and neuters our own propagandists so that we no longer need them. There are so many ways that this all loops back in itself. And I think with the low point of entry in terms of commitment to be part of an online movement, I think this works even better. And what it becomes is not an ability to subjugate insurgent groups, but to manifest them.
Well, when you look at this, we're going to move into some of David Bett's stuff, because we're about halfway through now. Well, probably a bit more than, but the next thing we could do with looking at is, one, a quick mention of the Northern Ireland situation. This is the bit from Roger Failgut, who's talking about Kitson. This is from Britain's Military Strategy in Ireland, the Kitson Experiment by Roger Failgut. This is the archive version of it, which doesn't seem to want to be very good here, but we do have a quote from it from you here. You want to read this one again, Evelyn?
Yeah. The man, British General Frank Kitson, was offered Ireland as testing ground for his theories, which, though initially considered by many as bizarre, were nevertheless progressively adopted and eventually accepted by the British Army and subsequently NATO. Control of populations, psychological warfare, the use of special units, and the overall expansion of intelligence services, the development of a new technology providing for containment, if not destruction, any expression of civil disobedience, of political trade union, nationalist, feminist, or ecological opposition, including urban guerrilla warfare, constitute the diverse elements of these theories. Special warfare is fought with computers and helicopters. Intelligence and the quick access to it are the trump cards. The target, the urban populations. A war of computer and helicopter, but above all, a set of principles which reflect the growing importance of the army in any counterinsurgency system. Now, that's the only thing Failgut, I think, missed here. Is what he's talking about is the necessary need for total vertical integration from top to bottom.
Yes.
Everyone at the bottom doesn't need to know they're involved in a counterinsurgency operation.
Yes.
They could just be doing their job. Being entrepreneurial, as Betts mentions elsewhere.
Yes.
Yet, what he recognises is that the top brass, unelected centres of intelligence gathering have to operate consciously with this subset of ideas in mind.
Yes. Should I finish it?
Yeah. As well as the integration of a political military apparatus which, prior to any potential uprising, offers a systematic surveillance of men and ideas, the infiltration and manipulation of political groupings, the trade union movement, the media, the social services, and ultimately the paralysis and the neutralisation of potential dissidents and opponents, i.e. the creation of bloody insurgent movements when you haven't got one to fight.
Well, there's an intelligence document here from 2009 which shows this complete adoption. This is a withdrawn version, but it does mention Kitson specifically. You've got a little thing here about the This is from that document, and it does just directly quote Kitson here. The mandate. Yeah. The mandate provides a legal framework to conduct operations. It also provides direction on freedom of actions and constraints. It talks about legitimacy, UK domestic and international law. There's the other bit here.
Powers of arrest, detention and internment. The mandate should lay down what, if any, powers of arrest, detention or internment are permitted. This will technically be the case when police primacy is inapplicable and the military are leading the fight against criminality. The mandate should specify who is permitted to detain those arrested and what rules apply to such detention. The police are unable to act effectively against criminals. The commander may need to make case for additional mandated powers.
It's pure, because he is mentioned in here about 17 times.
Yeah, he is mentioned. There's one quote here. It's basically, he says, all actions are designed to retain and regain the allegiance of the population.
Yes.
Sorry, I read that wrong. All actions designed to retain and regain the allegiance of the population are relevant to the process of collecting background information because its provision is closely geared to the attitude of the people. The whole national program of civil and military action has a bearing on the problem. You know, Kitson, throughout the entirety of low intensity operations, he's talking about this integration of the army with government, and he's essentially calling for a CIA-type system to be established.
Yeah,
I mean, where they have complete... Sorry, carry on.
Don't go on that, Rory.
So, he's talking about the primacy of intelligence, and he's talking mainly about these non-violent movements, which are these sorts of incubative stages of potential insurgent movements. And he's saying there's all these opportunities there for the army to get their fingers in there and to look for primary information on potential contacts and whatnot, and to identify exactly what is going on and in these movements, and indeed the importance of low-grade information here, where it's better to have tons and tons and tons of low-grade information than high-grade information, because you can create a picture with that, basically.
So I just noticed there was a quote here directly from Ketson's low-intensity operations right on the, was it the 14th page of this here. Yes. At the root of the problem lies the fact that the qualities required for fighting conventional war are different from those required with dealing with subversion or insurgency, or for taking part in peacekeeping operations for that matter. Traditionally, a soldier is trained in conditions to be strong, courageous, direct, and aggressive. But when men endowed with these qualities become involved in fighting subversion, they often find that their good points are exploited by the enemy.
Yeah, it basically says that regular soldiers would tell someone like Kitson to fuck off. They would actually tell Kitson that his way of waging war was dishonourable and in many ways evil.
But I also think what he's talking about there is the fact that these people were vulnerable to the talking points of the very people they were supposed to be stamping down on.
Well, yes. Yeah.
That is why information control is as important within as it is without.
He talks about perception and credibility, but all of these are strangely missing when we get to the latest version of this. There is no mention of Kitson. But what we have instead of Kitson is the 77th Brigade. Mm. it talks about the 77th Brigade.
Formerly known as the Security Assistance Group.
Yeah, it really talks about this as Kitson incarnate. I'll read this little bit here. Key contribution, 77th Brigade. Formerly known as the Security Assistance Group, 77th Brigade is a... one formulation created to enhance and integrate information activities and outreach capabilities in defense. By merging the Military Stabilization Support Group, Security Capability Building Team, 15 Psychological Operations Group, and the Army's Media Operations Group into a single entity. Now, anyone who knows anything about military operations should be like, holy crap. just them glossing over that. It archives, it achieves synergy across these capability areas and provides the basis for transformative change in the employment and future development. As a key defense partner, the Stabilization Unit, 710th Brigade contributes to analysis and planning at all levels and across Whitehall. The brigade contributes to contingent capability by supporting formation headquarters. This is primarily in the land environment, but also applies to the Joint Forces Command and the other services where required.
And a question for anyone that's studied their homework well enough. Who consults on stabilization theory these days?
Yeah, and the Stabilization Unit was folded into the Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office in 2020. So you have the Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office just has a unit in it, which is a sister unit of the 77th Brigade, which is the psychological warfare division of the army that is never supposed to be used against the population. Just a quick aside there. Here we get to Mr. David Betts. David Betts is Kitson incarnate. He takes Kitson's arguments and takes them as granted. Mm. All of these awful blank check counterinsurgency arguments that eschew the open use of power by a strong leader to be substituted with weak use of psychological warfare by quote-unquote weak democratic governments, i.e. governments who do not have the mandate, the will, or the strength to operate openly. Which is the bits you wanted to read from this? Because do you remember the quotes?
I just kept picking through bits of this yesterday, so, I mean, unless we want to go through anything in particular, we could do hours on the War of Ideas section in here alone.
There's a couple of bits you read earlier that really need reading. I thought you had those noted down.
No, I didn't, I'm afraid.
Oh, okay.
There's a couple of parts in here which I thought were pretty interesting.
Yes. Which page are they on?
It would be page 5. Well, it says 521 on the actual doc, but I think it's page 12 if it's the same document.
521. Keep it alone. About 12 here. Yeah, 521. Yes.
Yeah. So that part at the bottom, he's talking about Galula.
Yes.
He was involved in Algeria. And you know, Galula's whole thing was basically that he said the insurgents have the upper hand in terms of propaganda. Betts is contending with that idea and saying, actually, he says, he says that.
I mean,
sorry, this is a different document to the one I've read, but he's essentially arguing that actually the government has the upper hand in terms of propaganda, and they can use that upper hand to get the bad guys to stand up and show their hand, essentially.
Yes, I think the one of the parts that stood out to me when reading about that a little bit the other day in this one was the notion that, like, as you say, he tried to make it sound as if the regime itself can't do propaganda of the deed, but in the wake of something like COVID, given the fact that what this paper is telling us is that the narrative doesn't actually have to make sense, not on a day-to-day matter or in a week-to-week matter, but as long as year-to-year they still remain in power, then that's really all they need for legitimacy. So ad hoc and long time after the fact, they can just sort of turn around and go, well, yes, we did actually just lock up dissidents and punish them willy-nilly during COVID. What are you going to do about it? It's, as you say, it's that sort of asymmetric aspect of it again, where they're going, oh, we better make sure our enemies don't do this, which is really a way of suggesting we better beat them to the punch.
A lot of this paper is dedicated to Betts justifying the information war in regards to the war on terror. So I really thought you had those bits. I should have noted them down then.
We both should have, shouldn't we? Made a cock up there, haven't we?
Oh, great. No, so there's some really there's some bits of this we really need to read, and I can't remember where they are. So, I really did think you wrote that down when you were.
Should have asked.
Give me a second.
There is a part in this where he's talking about a counterinsurgent guy who's essentially saying that the. I'll try and find it quickly, sorry.
There's another version here that's on Scribble, but it's kind of terrible. Scribble's not a very good service.
That's what I'm going off.
He does go into this. Oh, God, I'm trying to find a little bit here. God, these are so difficult. We'll go over this document on its own in our War on Terror section, because we're going to do another stream in follow-up to this about the War on Terror and David Betts.
But a large part of what's in this, I think, for what we're really talking about the stream this evening, we've sort of covered. It's the recognition of the asymmetric ways in which you go about distributing propaganda,
yes,
so that your own people are concise and have something that's maybe not necessarily true, but unquestionable. And then making sure that your enemy can constantly be questioned, even if what they're saying is true. And it's about relying on a sort of confidence trick to keep the people you want in a state not so much of confusion, but more so just constant misdirection.
Well, it's what he gets into the Islamist threat here, but it really could be used by really could be used on any part of the population here. It's to do with the virtual dimension. So I'll just quote a little bit of it here. Haymes argues that the war we now face is one in which our opponent uses all available networks, political, economic, social, and military, to convince the enemy's political decision makers that their strategic goals are either unachievable or too costly for the perceived benefit. It is rooted in the fundamental precept that the superior political will, when properly employed, can defeat greater economic and military power. That if And if it's the case, then we are ignoring the defense of a critical vulnerability. It is though we had entered some gladiatorial combat with helmet visor closed, sword dull and bent, and shield lying in the dirt. The United States in particular is, it is argued, possesses a quagmire mentality which gifts its enemies with a playbook for its feet.
I mean, we could go on to the next point here as well. Fourth, and most importantly, we struggle to be persuasive in the virtual dimension because the messages that we wish to convey lack narrative coherence.
Yes.
Basically, what we say does not align with what we do. Others have noted the enormous harm our cause is done by the evident gap between our democratic rhetoric in the virtual dimension and our tactical actions in the physical one. The words of Sidney Blumenthal in a scathing open letter to Karen Hughes, former Undersecretary of Public Diplomacy in the State Department: your position is one in which form and content stand in opposition to each other. Now, at no point in the rest of this paper does he say stop doing that.
Yes.
What he says is, this is a truth and we must reframe it.
Well, he talks about propaganda 2.0, key components. He also talks about narrative coherence a lot. He talks about the fact that a war needs to have
an eschatological narrative, something that comes to an end point and is a sort of overriding metaphysic of your, of both your counterinsurgency and their insurgency.
On this point, he talks about the sort of importance of the counterinsurgent propagandist.
Mm.
And he talks about this sort of this dynamic of a producer and a director at one point as well, if I remember
he's
correctly.
He's quoting here John Hopkins professor Valos, and he also mentions a guy called Sir Lawrence Freedman, both of which are RAND Corporation, DOD, and Ministry of Defense alums. In war, narrative is much more than just a story. Narrative may sound like a fancy literary word, but is actually the formation of all strategy upon which all else, policy, rhetoric, and action is built. War narratives need to be identified and critically examined on their own terms, or they can illuminate the inner nature of war itself. War narrative does three essential things. First, it is the organizing framework for policy. Policy cannot exist without the interlocking formation of truths that people can easily accept, because they appear to be self-evident and undeniable. Second, the story works the framework precisely because it represents just such an existential version. The truths that it asserts are, I think this is one of the things we're looking for, are culturally impossible to disassemble or even criticize. Third, having presented a war logic that is beyond dispute, the narrative then serves practically as the anointed rhetorical handbook for how the war is to be argued and described. Friedman, or more concise, refers to the strategic narratives as compelling storylines which can explain events convincingly and from which inferences can be drawn. Both emphasize two things, however, which are vital for this discussion, because they illustrate the challenge we face as counterinsurgents on the virtual battlefield, and because they go a long way to explaining why a preponderance of power in the physical dimension belies a more profound anemia in the virtual one. Strategic narratives do not arise spontaneously, but are deliberately constructed or reinforced out of the ideas and thoughts that are already current. They express a sense of identity and belonging and communicate a sense of cause, purpose, and mission. Strategic narratives are not analytical and, when not grounded in evidence or experience, may rely on appeals to emotion or on suspect metaphors and dubious historical analogies. What he's basically saying here is tell a better lie, tell a better story. But he's doing this, if we go back to the top of the paper, the real trick is that he's not saying anything here that isn't true, but he's applying all of this knowledge, all of this counterinsurgency to perpetuating the forever wars. What David Betts is arguing is that no lie is too big to keep the forever wars going. That is what this paper is really saying. But in relation to strategic narratives for the far right, this can be applied equally, as in this works for any counterinsurgency. It presupposes that what the counterinsurgency wants is correct. And it presupposes here, again, we'll probably have a whole stream on this because there's a whole other section we need to read here. But there's far too much to get through just in this stream. So that was the bit I was looking for. So we've not actually missed anything here. But the virtual dimension of contemporary insurgency and counterinsurgency is just David Betts saying why we should line an unlimited capacity to keep the war on terror going.
But it's about changing the state of the water. It's about completely readapting the psychological conditions of those in the environment itself instead of actually attempting to deal with the problems that are causing the insurgent movement to arise.
Yes.
But I think this is where we get into another part of the unspoken portion we might get into a little bit more towards the end here, which is to what extent is Betts now coming out with his Civil War guff actually a way to bolster the untrue narrative that there is an insurgent far right in Britain?
Well, there's this section here which I do quickly want to read because it is extremely important. This is from the 2010 paper that is a reformulation of that 2008 paper, which is then reformulated in here. If you guys had any doubts about David, you know, any thoughts about defending David Betts, this is where his opinions end up. He is a NATO PSYOP mouthpiece. He is part of the consent manufacturer. We've not got time today, but we'll go into it. But there are bits in that 2008 document we just read from that effectively advocate for the creation of the 77th Brigade.
Mm.
Almost in those terms. But he has a section here simply called long fucking forward here. There we go.
Putting the strategy back into strategic communications, David Betts and Von Phillips.
And it's basically him doing all the counterinsurgency stuff again.
Yes.
It's a reformulation of this. But this is a quote from 2010. Propaganda operates on the individual level of the unconscious. Condition of the success propaganda is that the subject must not know that he or she is being shaped by outside forces, largely by appeal to and manipulation of deep psychological basis of society. A Lull, 1965, that's propaganda. In a war of survival, this is easy because people unconsciously welcome propaganda which aims to sustain morale and determination at home, while undermining the same things in a dangerous enemy. But in a war of choice, particularly in the case of the third-party intervention to prop up an unpopular foreign government, the unconscious predisposition of individuals be propagandized is much less. Propaganda is a vital aspect of insurgency and counterinsurgency, where it is more powerful tool for the insurgent than it is for the counterinsurgent, is a good question. Galula in 1964 argues that it is. The asymmetrical situation has important effects on propaganda, the insurgent having no responsibilities, free to use every trick. Consequently, propaganda is a powerful weapon for him. The counterinsurgent is tied to his responsibilities and to his past, and for him, facts speak louder than words. For him, propaganda can be no more than a secondary weapon, valuable only if intended to inform and not to fool. There is much wisdom in what Galula says. There is that the counterinsurgent must not lie too boldly. If at all, he again, read between the lines here, ought to be regarded as something akin to a scientific law. However, what Gala says also represents probably the most fundamental and widespread theoretical mistake in the entire literature. Facts speak louder than words for both sides. In crude terms, the job of the counterinsurgent propagandist is to make the insurgent stand up for their actions.
Flip the propaganda of the deed on its bloody head.
We can really see this happen in a lot of kind of the Tommy style stuff, though, and a lot of the immigration style stuff as well.
I'd say in this context that, you know, he is the counterinsurgent propagandist, and
yes,
what is all this civil war stuff about? It's about making people. It's about it's getting people to identify themselves, basically.
Yes. Well, and I don't think that Aunt Middleton is going to march on London and create a green zone with some sort of armed paramilitary group. But that is the reality that David Betts wants to paint inside your head.
And you could consider
why it is that he's doing that. Now, I'm not going to specifically call anyone out here because we all make mistakes, but if the man's speciality beyond counterinsurgency is fortifications, and you purport to be part of a group of dissidents who want to buy old fortified buildings from the Middle Ages maybe don't have David Betts on to have a discussion about it.
So we've talked about Kitson's framework. We've talked about how a lot of David Betts' language and his counterinsurgency stuff comes directly from him and people who study him. Mm. He references people who reference Kitson a lot. And we've seen this with its counterinsurgency. He's gone through 2008, 2010, published in NATO and a NATO magazine, basically, in 2017 about counterinsurgency. And in 2023, something changes. He pops up with, quite frankly, one of the most ridiculous social science papers I have ever seen. I'm not going to read this through. I'm just going to read this bit, which I put out earlier.
Yeah, we talked about this before, because, I think, on the stream about it.
Because, like, David Betts thinks you are fucking retarded. And the problem is that many of you are. You know, I'll put it on screen with fucking... Yeah, there it is.
I have attempted to assess the mood and amorphous plans of inseparate revolutionaries through consistent looking over a decade on the anonymous image boards 4chan and 8chan poll, a range of Twitter and Telegram channels and websites, and surprisingly usefully, the user review sections of controversial books on Amazon and Goodreads.
Unsystematic...
At least he's not reading them from Withlings.
My impressions are broadly in accord with those of other researchers of extremist groups, notably the Southern Poverty Law Center
and the International Center for the Study of Radicalization,
which is just his little vertical at King's fucking College. He's self-referencing there.
Dissolved September 2025, that, though. That's interesting.
It's been folded into another little department.
I was going to see what that be reformulated into.
But this is where David Betts, you know, Mary Harrington, everyone who platformed David Betts got his Civil War framework from reading 4chan, the hacker known as 4chan. Who is this hacker known as 4chan? 8chan, Twitter, Telegram. Basically, he's repackaging shitposts to say there's going to be a civil war, stupid. If you read the literature, what a lot of these people say is that, well, you can't use this not during wartime. What's David Betts doing? He's going out there and reframing disorder and the disaffected opinions to do with immigration as an insurgency. There is no organized resistance to mass immigration in Britain, and that's a huge problem. But David Betts would like to not only portray it as organized, but so organized that it would cause a civil conflict. The reason that David Betts says civil war is that so he can portray it as an insurgency, because he is a counterinsurgency expert and his insurgency comes from shitposts on 4chan. That's how fucking stupid you are. All of you out there who went, David Betts, you're wrong about David. Look at this. Look at how stupid you are if you listen to David Betts. Look at what you got hoodwinked with. He's either an idiot, he's a boomer who sat there reading 4chan, I think there's going to be civil war, or he's a counterinsurgency expert who's trying to get you to have a controlled reaction. Because what is a counterinsurgency without an insurgency?
Indeed.
Sorry, I'll get this up. And it is a counterinsurgency in search of insurgents. If you look at Kitson's framework and David Betts' use of it, again, we've not fully run out of time here, but we'll read more of those papers next time we stream, because some of the stuff in there is absolutely extraordinary. But now we know that David Betts is somebody who completely made up his Civil War narrative from shitposts on the internet. We realize that as a counterinsurgency expert, what he's doing is portraying a strong insurgency, that then the people that he works with, i.e. NATO and the intelligence services, the people he works for, can come in and therapeutize and counter that insurgency.
Right, and I don't know if you want to get the other slide we've got there as well, because I think this is very important. The point that needs to be made. If Betts, like Kitson, is being given an opportunity to run roughshod over elements of the British population and specifically target them with psychological operations with the explicit purpose of manipulating the environment around them so that they get behaviours beneficial to what they want, then do you know what? Don't go running around on Twitter becoming part of an insurgency that doesn't actually exist.
The movement has formed.
Stop giving this a breath of fresh air when it doesn't have any? I mean, this is really a fundamental thing that we've been trying to get people to understand since the very start of us doing this. Stop giving their strategies energy. Stop bolstering their narrative by attempting to be part of a movement that doesn't exist and only exists in the abstract for their bloody purposes. If you had all these people that were going to the Epping protest and we are doing this and we're putting the flags up, we're doing all that, a large part of the stuff they are now using to justify the strengthening of this narrative is directly from those events. And people went, oh, but I'm shifting the Overton window.
Well, there's one final bit you sent here. Is it the purple bit?
The whole thing, but yes. Yeah, it's pertaining to what we're talking about right now. I think it has
been shown that in the pre-violence period, the enemy is likely to be occupied in spreading his cause by propaganda of one sort or another, and in clamping a tight control on the people in the form of a chain of committees and cells to ensure that they accept the message and are thereafter in a position to act against the government in furtherance of the cause. In order to counter these moves, the government first know about them in detail, which means that it must build up and adapt its intelligence organisation to meet the threat. It must also promote its own cause and undermine that of the enemy by disseminating its view of the situation, and this involves a carefully planned and coordinated campaign of what, for want of a better word, must be regrettably called psychological operations. And if that isn't GB news, I don't know what is.
Well, yeah, you've got someone there to sum up, like David Betts, who is a counterinsurgency expert who has spent decades writing the consent manufacture for the unlimited psychological warfare that is the War on Terror. The War on Terror has very obviously been brought home to be used on domestic populations. One of his babies, really, rhetorically and ideologically and intellectually, is the 77th Brigade. It represents everything he said in 2008 that the UK government should do and more. He is somebody who believes in the necessity of organizations like that. And when you get someone like that who is pushing this civil war narrative, you understand that what the point of a counterinsurgency is to appear justified in counterpunching. It's what managerial governments always do. They always pretend they are reacting to a crisis or a potential crisis reluctantly, that they would rather things stay as they are, but we would love things to be liberal and open and democratic, but
we'd love to fix these things for you, but...
But the what you need to conduct the psychological warfare, the behavioural engineering, the nudge units, is you need a cause to fight against. You need... The classic example is things like Just Stop Oil and all of the stuff that we talked about when we
Palestine had Action and all
Palestine
that.
Action, all of this stuff. I'll get this off screen for a second here, but we have things like government-funded, museum-funded climate awareness, climate cafes, basically climate radicalization workshops. And then we also have new laws to clamp down on disruptive protests.
Yeah, so I mean,
that's a very easy two sides of the same process. There he goes. I'm echoing there a bit.
I mean, I would like to maybe even... I'm not saying you've got to get it up because there's no point in going all the way back through that thing now, but the original article I wrote at the start of last year, 2024, and sort of being in the wilderness, that we had an unprecedented growth in the funding and the bolstering of quote-unquote anti-leftist narratives in media, that at the same time we had one of the biggest developments of MI5 policy for managing extreme right-wing terrorist movements. And some of the things they described as extreme in their own framework were some of the very arguments being made on GB News at the very same time. Now, is that because the guys in GB News are renegades and they're pushing at the Overton window? No, because it's about creating a space in which some insurgency happens, but not enough to actually become a problem.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts, Roy? Do you think there is this very obvious strain of I'd say insurgency manufacturing in all of this containment kind of nexus in this operation?
I think there's an organic element to, you know, I don't even want to call them movements because, you know, they're all, none of them are real movements, but I do think there's an, I think a good example is the flagging thing. You know, it yes. started off as this sort of ostensibly organic movement, and suddenly you had websites like Flagforce UK popping up. You know, that's indicative to me of some kind of counter gang operation to essentially gather intelligence on potentially dissident groups or actors. So wherever there's these sorts of movements which pop up, the state's immediately on it with intelligence and informants and other things to get ahead of these movements before they can become anything substantial or organized.
I'll quickly say, sorry, we do have a few donations. Thank you at DigBic1034. Thanks for the content. Thanks for £10. Coney Current Year says, you're up against the governments that defeat the Mau Mau Uprising, Malaysia's communists, and the Irish Republican Army. Act accordingly. Fair enough. All replacement ideologies need material resources.
That's meant to be Althazer, I think, that was right about that.
Yes, yes, sir.
And Ra8784 Tenor says, for the pint fund.
Yes. What I would say is that don't... And thank you for this, Rory. Thank you for bringing all this research to us. Are there any kind of more... Is there any aspect of this you think we've missed or underemphasized before we get off at all?
I don't think... well, only that... Kitson was heavily involved with the RAND Corporation, and you know, he was going to the RAND meetings during the 70s and 80s, and he was essentially saying everyone there was speaking from the same standpoint. And you know, as you know, with RAND, they were very heavily involved with DARPA and later ARPANET. So essentially, the internet is a massive counterinsurgency operation in itself. So just be aware of what you're saying to anyone who's listening, really.
As Simeogog says, when you're on the internet, you're inside their informational weapon.
Yes, and I think that's an important point. I think we could spend all day describing the motivations for why they've done this, and it's something we probably will converse about at some point. But rather, I'd rather stress to people the importance of actually being inactive in this environment. If you could be inactive in it in such a way that you could suck energy out of it by being exposed to it and it not having an effect on you, then that's maybe worth doing. But otherwise, separate yourself from it entirely.
Yes.
Because clearly, what we are seeing here is not just the instructions to deal with a movement that is a genuine oppositional threat, but this is also how you would reverse engineer something that isn't a threat into one that is. And I think there are a lot of people who are well-meaning, who aren't motivated by anything untoward and do not work for people who we could describe quite directly as feds, but will eventually do their bidding because they can't understand that at some point they'll flip the switch and you won't be the free, loving patriot anymore. You'll be ISIS.
Yes.
You know, at some point, the Mujahideen has to become ISIS. At some point, the Tommy Robinson Patriots have to become the people that go in the gulags. It might not happen exactly like that, but it's obviously the risk we've got to bloody consider.
What we also seem to have found is that the low-level disaffection, the disorganized result of decline and the reduction in the actual British population is being therapeutized by being shaped into a movement that doesn't exist and then counterinsurgent.
Mm.
You know, an insurgency is being invented around those lines before it can take hold. What really is here is a train of thought, which is that all non-hegemonic thought is insurgency. All counter-managerial thought is insurgency. And really what you have here is a counterinsurgency against the truth, against ethnic reality, against realities of the failures of multiculturalism, against realities of the complete
the existential
failure.
Nature of the survival of British civilization.
Yes, and the British people as a people. All of these things are treated as insurgent, but you can't run a counterinsurgency against reality. But that's what we're seeing here. But conversely, you shouldn't make yourself the willing insurgent in a counterinsurgency operation. All of those people talking about patriots in charge, patriots here, civil war, I'm going to be a general during the civil war, all these people are elites in waiting. All you're doing is doing the counterinsurgency intelligence services job for them.
Stay sensible, stay centered.
Yes, stay safe. I will say thank you for being on, Rory. If you want to follow Rory, he is the guy who puts together the Islander magazine.
Which I believe they've got some new fancy one coming out after Christmas. So once you've bought yourself anti-politics for Christmas, dear viewer, maybe consider buying yourself that as well.
All that's left for me to say is we will have another stream on this specifically related to the war on terror stuff.
We could probably do a whole stream on that 2008 paper because that is on itself.
I'll talk more about the Rand Corporation, Kitson, the close ties to the military industrial complex of all of these people. But we wanted to have this stream with Rory because the most important thing I think is that people don't understand counterinsurgency.
No.
They don't understand that making themselves look like a credible threat is an essential part of the equation.
It's how you become a credible threat.
Yeah, well, in quote, it's an essential part of the equation in how suppression takes place. Anyway,
I will say just before we finish, people often say, you know, what do we do? Doing nothing sometimes isn't the worst idea. Quietism is a form of practice in this instance. So don't see it as blackpilling, because often you're shooting yourself in the foot by getting involved in these movements in the first place.
Absolutely. Amen to that. Right. Do you mind telling everyone who's currently watching this stream to go to the pub?
Yes. Please do go to the pub. Anyway, we'll do some outro music here. Thanks you guys watching. Goodbye.